Dennis Prager is a best-selling author. He's a nationally syndicated talk show radio host and has been for the past 35 years. He appears regularly on Fox News and CNN. Mr. Prager writes a nationally syndicated weekly column, and it is present in major international publications like the Wall Street Journal and the National Review. Mr. Prager co-founded Prager University in 2011, which is a nonprofit, and they create short 5-minute videos. I'm sure a lot of you have seen them, featuring well-known presenters about a variety of topics. So without further ado, let's introduce Mr. Prager.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Wow. Wow. Oh, my God. Wow. Thank you. Thank you. I'm sure not all of you feel that enthusiastic about seeing me, but nevertheless, for those of you who are enthusiastic, I'm very touched. I really am touched. I want to tell you, I don't know if this is a good or bad thing to tell you, but I am known for being open, and I've taken risks, and it's usually worked. And one of my proudest achievements is I have been to all 50 states. But the prouder achievement will be when I have lectured in all 50. This is my 47th. So it's a very big night for me. So if you know anybody in Montana or the Dakotas, I will come and talk about aardvarks, whatever is on their mind. I will just be happy to go there. I'm very happy to see you. I'm sorry about the raucous that ensued before my coming, and I want to address it because it's a very, very important thing to address, because it's happening all over America. It's a crisis in America, in fact. The crisis is the creating of lies about decent people. And it needs to be acknowledged for what it is, lies about decent people. I don't care if people differ with me. That's why I always invite people who differ with me onto my radio show. And I never yell at them, and I never humiliate them, and I never attack them. I have no problem in differing with people. It's a wonderful thing to have differences of opinion. If everybody thinks the same, there's something awry. But there's a very big difference between differing and throwing the worst possible labels onto a human being who doesn't deserve it. If I am all of the things that were said by some of your fellow students, then we have a real problem, because A, I'm not, and then when the real Nazis and anti-Semites and racists and misogynists white supremacists show up, there will be no vocabulary left. What these people are doing, aside from smearing decent people, which is in itself a terrible thing, what they're doing is they are completely undermining the fight against real racism, real white supremacy, real misogyny, real xenophobia, and real racism. That's the irony. They are the worst possible source of weakening of the battle against real evil, by cheapening these things. To give you an idea of really the absurdity, it's aside from immorality, the absurdity of the language used in my case. The very first statements said I was an anti-Semite. Now, theoretically, a Jew can be an anti-Semite. It's theoretically possible, but it's not common, right? It takes an effort to hate yourself. It can be done. It can, and anything is possible. But in my case, it's particularly stupid. I've written 2 books on Judaism. One of them is the best-selling English language introduction to Judaism. It's been in print since I was 25 years old and wrote it at 25. It's still in print. Simon & Schuster, you can get it on Amazon. I wrote another book which is three times reprinted by Simon & Schuster on anti-Semitism. I was sent to the Soviet Union before you were born, when there was a Soviet Union, to work to bring Jews out of the Soviet Union at some risk to myself. But knowing Russian and Hebrew, I was a good choice to do that work. I have devoted my life to Judaism and to helping Jews, and I was called an anti-Semite. Then, even to them, it looked a little bizarre. And so they dropped it. But why did they do it? That's what matters. Because they had as much evidence that I was an anti-Semite as they do that I condone and advocate. Oh, excuse me, not just condone, advocate rape. Advocate rape. My wife, who is with me, and I'll introduce her. Sue, would you stand up? So, my wife said to me tonight, she said, they don't understand how insulting it is to me as your wife. I married a man who advocates rape? it's as bizarre as the anti-Semite charge. Advocate or condone rape? Rape is despicable. It's a non-issue. I don't know anybody. First of all, to be honest, I don't know anybody who condones rape. I have to admit, in all of my years on earth, I never met anybody who had a banner, "We like rape." No, I take it back. ISIS, but I don't know anybody in ISIS. I have to admit, they don't tend to listen to my radio show. They don't watch PragerU videos, to the best of my knowledge. Now, here's the thing, though. On what grounds? This was what fascinated me, because I had one of the protesters on my show for an hour, a whole hour. And I said, on what grounds do you make the charge, and you and the woman who has been organizing a lot of this, that I advocate rape? And it turns out that it is from a piece that I wrote in my syndicated column of many decades. So I don't only write on politics. I don't only broadcast on politics. I care about just about everything in life. I've done a male-female hour on my radio show for about 15 years, every single Wednesday, an hour on men and women getting along better with each other, and it's a very honest hour. And I want to tell you, one of the proudest things of my life is the number of people who've told me that that hour has saved their marriage. That is as wonderful a thing that I have ever been told in my life. A woman from Brazil once called and said, I listened to your show on the internet and you saved my marriage. That's all I want to do with that hour, but you have to tell the truth to tell people. So one of the things I wrote a two-part piece about 15 years ago, 10 years ago, whatever it was, and it's titled, When a Woman is Not in the Mood. And everyone in this room knows in the mood to do what? There's no one is saying to do what? To have Chinese food? Okay. And it is about not just a woman, it is about a wife. And it's not just about a wife, it is about a wife, and I make this clear in the piece, who is married to a good man. I emphasize it over and over. She loves her husband loves her. And so, is that the crowd? Or is it? I'm just curious. No, it doesn't matter. It's not important. So the issue was, you love your husband loves you. And the question is, should you be always governed by your mood? If you're not in the mood to have sex, should you on occasion, just because you love him and he loves you, still have sex? And I said, don't always let your mood dictate your behavior. Which, by the way, is not the origin of my theory about not letting moods dictate your behavior. The origin comes from all of my work on happiness. Because the longest ongoing show of mine is the Happiness Hour. I started it in 1999. Even the week of 9/11, I broadcast my Happiness Hour. It is a discussion about happiness. I've written a book on it. Happiness is a Serious Problem is the title. And that too has helped a lot of people. My theory is, don't be governed by your mood in anything, anything. Behavior should not be dependent on mood. And I want to explain to you where I learned this. I know exactly the day I learned it. I was in fourth grade. I went to a type of school that some of you will have heard of, many of you will not, called a yeshiva. A yeshiva is 9 to 5. Half the day is in Hebrew, Jewish religious studies. Half the day in English, secular studies. It's an intense day. I failed all day, but I was there all day and still learned a lot. Fourth grade, the rabbi announces, this is an Orthodox Jewish school, and the rabbi in the class announces, okay, boys, because only boys are required to pray 3 times a day. I did have female envy for a good part of my life, just on that basis. In any event, he said, okay, boys, it is now time to daven mincha, which is the Hebrew Jewish way, Yiddish Jewish way of saying to pray the afternoon prayers. I walked over to him. I always had chutzpah, I always had nerve, but I never had disrespect. So I respectfully said, Rabbi Fosdag, I just want you to know I'm not in the mood to daven mincha. I'm not in the mood to pray the afternoon prayers. The man was from Eastern Europe. He spoke perfect English, but he had clearly, even I realized in fourth grade, never heard the words mood and prayer in the same sentence. He stroked his beard, looked up, and then said, Dennis Prager is not in the mood for afternoon prayers. So what? The man changed my life permanently. I'm not kidding. It was one of the most important learning experiences of my life. He taught me that how I felt didn't matter. You have obligations in life that have nothing to do with how you feel. And this has been the essence of my approach to happiness. My view on happiness in this regard is very simple. If you're in a bad mood, you have no right to impose it on other people, to inflict it on others. Just like you don't impose bad breath or bad body odor on others, you should wash away your mood like you wash away your breath or your body odor. We don't shower every day for hygienic reasons. You'd be perfectly fine showering once a week. You shower every day to keep your friends. Okay, that's the major reason, and I the same. And so with mood, you can't inflict your bad moods on others. You should act cheerful. I don't mean manic, just cheerful, even if you're in a bad mood. So this has been my approach to all of life, and I applied it to the sexual arena in a marriage. Don't let mood be the only thing that determines whether or not you have relations. Now, obviously, on many occasions, it won't be practical or whatever it will be. But how on God's earth is that defending or even advocating rape? The whole point was addressed to the woman. You have to consent despite your mood. If you don't consent, it's a non-issue. It's on those grounds that I was declared to be an advocate of rape. Do you understand? It's actually the charges made, and I'm not saying this because I need to defend me. I don't need to defend me. I need to prosecute them. We need moral clarity. What they are doing is morally disgusting. That is what must be clear. It's also intellectually pathetic. I am as much an advocate of rape as I am of anti-Semitism. What else was on the list? Let's see, advocate, oh yes, racist. So I asked this gentleman, how is it that I spew hate against blacks? Folks, I have written well over 1 million words. There is not a word I have ever written that could be twisted into spewing hate against blacks. And there's a very simple reason. Because to me, I have always said this, not only do I loathe racism, after all, if there has been a group that has been a greater victim of racism than the Jews in the 20th century, I don't know what group that is. Two out of every three European Jews was exterminated, including babies, for being Jewish and not being Aryan. So the thought that I would entertain that there is something nice or noble or defensible about racism is an absurdity. But there's another reason. I've always said it's just stupid. The idea that race matters is stupid. Aside from evil, it's stupid. It matters as much as shoe size. Skin color is as important as shoe size. Okay, that's my belief. So where exactly did I spew hate? So the answer was that I have written that America is the least racist country that has ever had multi-ethnic and multiracial groups live within it. That's spewing hate. Okay, so I want you to understand the moral and intellectual foundations of the charges made. And by the way, I stand by that. One of the reasons I love America, and many reasons I love America, is precisely that. Here's just a little statistic I'm sure you don't know, but believe me, I wouldn't tell it to you if I weren't certain of it. It was printed in the New York Times in the 1990s, if not the 1980s. More black Africans have emigrated to the United States willingly than came over on slave ships. Does that in any way mitigate the evil, the sheer undiluted evil of the slave ship, a torture ship on the sea? Of course not. But it's still something to be aware of. Clearly, a lot of blacks came to America thinking it was a good place to go to. They're not stupid. They're not moving to a racist place. They're moving to a place of opportunity. I asked a guy who was a black guy who was doing my shoes at JFK about a year or two ago. I told this on the radio. I said, where are you from? And I think it was West Africa, somewhere in West Africa. And I've been all over West Africa, so we discussed where he was from. And then I said, I'm just curious, do you think America's a racist country? It was very interesting. He didn't know what to say, and I understood why he didn't know what to say. He didn't know what to say. He gave me an answer, but he gave it sheepishly. He said, well, no. He was like apologizing for not holding that America's racist, because he was going against what he felt is the dominant belief in America, that America is a racist country. But it isn't, any more than it's an anti-Semitic country. There are anti-Semites in America. Folks, I'm in my late 60s. I have lived in America all my life except 1 year in England. I never met an anti-Semite. How is that possible? Do they avoid me? I'm 6'4", I'm tough to miss. And I'm a public Jew. Where are they? I know they exist. I'm not an idiot. Of course there are anti-Semites in America. But I have to say that for this Jew's experience, this has been, and I know this as a fact, as one who taught Jewish history at Brooklyn College, this has been the greatest place for Jews to live in Jewish history. The United States of America, it's been a blessing to Jews. My father, this is an interesting thing, my father wrote his senior class thesis at City College of New York in the 40s. Or the 30s. No, it would have been, he was born in 1918, so late 30s. He wrote his senior class thesis on anti-Semitism in America, which existed. Absolutely. There were firms that wouldn't hire, he was an accountant, there were firms that wouldn't hire him because he was Jewish. But my father raised my brother and me to believe we were the luckiest Jews in Jewish history to live in America. The man who wrote his senior class thesis on anti-Semitism in America. I compare him to a black columnist at the New York Times named Charles Blow, who believes America literally is hell. He describes America today as hell frequently hell, which shows you how he doesn't know what hell is like. It shows you how good his life is. If being a New York Times columnist is hell, well, what's heaven? And he raises his children about how racist Americans are. And all I could say is I feel terrible for his children. I contrast them to my father's children, my brother and myself, raised to so appreciate this country, even though he really was in a place that did have anti-Semites. But he knew what a blessing this country was. Next one. This was in caps to make sure you read it carefully. He literally justified genocide of millions of innocent people because he thinks white people are superior. Listen for yourselves. So I listened for myself, and I heard me for 5 minutes on my radio show, and I was still wondering, where did I justify genocide of millions or white supremacy? How do you listen to that and come away thinking I justify genocide or white supremacy? It's painful that these things even have a life of their own in any way. Okay, so I wanted to answer some of the truly vile and stupid charges that were made. The left has trivialized anti-Semitism, racism, rape, genocide, xenophobia, etc. The rape issue has been truly done to this notion that 1 in 5 women are sexually assaulted or raped at college. I have asked a simple question. What father or mother would send their daughter to a place where she had a 1 in 5 chance of being raped or sexually assaulted? The people who make the charges don't even believe their own lies. That's the proof. There isn't a single leftist who doesn't send their daughter to college. They don't believe their own lies. That's what's so amazing. It's a sick world. It is a sick world. And let me make something very clear. Left is not the same as liberal. I respect liberals. I don't respect leftists. Liberals, when I grew up, liberals had, I'll give you one example, the race issue. The liberal value was integration and race doesn't matter. That's what conservatives now believe. Leftists believe race matters and in segregation. Harvard has separate graduations for black graduate students. Dartmouth has black dorms. Liberals opposed black dorms. That's racist. A black dorm is a racist institution by definition. That's leftist. The left view on race is the most race-honoring belief since the Nazis. I'm not calling the left Nazis. I'm very specific. The left's view on race is the most race-honoring view since the Nazis honored race. That's the moral upside-down world in which we live. So the topic was, socialism makes you selfish. I didn't forget the title. According to all sorts of opinion polls, your generation, half of you believe in socialism and not capitalism. So let me respond to a few things, the moral and the economic. I'll just begin with the economic. The only thing that has ever raised large numbers of people from abject poverty is capitalism. Nothing else in the history of humanity has raised large numbers of people from abject poverty. You would think that would matter to people who care about people living in abject poverty, but they don't. That's the interesting thing. People on the left care about equality, not prosperity. It's a different moral world. Just understand that. They live in a different moral world, and clarity is our best friend. They don't care about lifting large numbers of people from abject poverty. They care about the inequality in the Western world. But inequality only bothers people who are bothered by inequality. That's a tautology, obviously. In other words, only if you resent the fact that some people make more than others, do you resent inequality. Inequality doesn't bother me. I always tell the story. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, in the middle of the middle of the middle class. And I know, by the way, there was a way when I was a kid to measure what class you were in by what GM car you drove. There were five models, and you was totally based on economic class. Cadillac, Buick, Oldsmobile, Pontiac, Chevrolet. We were Oldsmobile, straight across the board. The thought of owning a Buick was so beyond anything we could imagine, but amazingly, the guy next door to us drove a Cadillac. And I remember, and he got a new one every year. He was so much richer than my parents. And I swear to you, on all that is holy to me, it never occurred to me to resent the fact that he was so much richer. My father or mother never evinced even a hint that Mr. Klein, to this day, I don't know what his first name was. We only knew adults as Mr. or Mrs. That's what I knew. He's Mr. Klein. Mr. Klein got a new Cadillac every year. All we thought was, lucky Mr. Klein. That was it. Hooray for Mr. Klein. He got a Cadillac. But it never occurred to me that having an Olds was two steps down. It's just the way it was. We couldn't afford a Buick and we couldn't afford a Cadillac. That's it. So what? I mean, do you resent shortstops make more than surgeons? Is that fair? No. In some utopian world, it isn't fair because surgeons save more lives than shortstops. Okay, that's just a fact. But it doesn't matter. In a free society, shortstops will make more than teachers and surgeons and nurses and all people doing sweet and good things. That's just the way it is, and it's okay. Why would it bother me? If they make their money legally and ethically, why do I care? I don't care. They care because they covet. They resent the fact that some people have more than others. Capitalism. Capitalism, not socialism, has taken people out of poverty. Capitalism also has a lot of inequality, because all liberty will have inequality. If you develop an iPhone, you make a lot of money. That's just the way it is. And everybody likes using some sort of smartphone. That's good. It's good for everybody. Why does it hurt me if some guy has billions of dollars? It doesn't hurt me in any way. It helps me because I am more productive thanks to what that person has developed. Socialism spends the money that capitalism creates. That is what you need to understand. Socialism does not produce wealth. Only capitalism produces wealth. And the only moral question is not why is there poverty? The only moral question is why is there wealth? Poverty is the norm. Wealth is the aberration. All of the world was impoverished, but capitalism saved them from it. So that's the moral argument just for raising people from poverty. Now the other moral argument, socialism and all of the doctrines of the left make people, generally speaking, more selfish and in many other ways morally worse than they were before. Well, let me give you the biggest single example. Let me read to you a statistic. Americans give more charity per capita per income than any other people in the world. Okay? Let me read to you. This is the Comparative Nonprofit Sector Project at the Johns Hopkins Center for Civil Society. It compiled a ranking of private philanthropy in 36 countries from 1995 to 2002. Based on giving alone, the United States comes first, giving 1.85% of GDP. followed by Israel at 1.34%. By the way, isn't it interesting that the two most hated countries in the world are the two most generous countries in the world? Isn't that fascinating? It shows you how sick anti-Americanism and anti-Zionism are. I have that in my book my book on anti-Semitism has a whole chapter on anti-Americanism. Next, one fact stands out. This is Forbes, December 26, 2008. Among developed nations, those with higher taxes and bigger social safety nets tend to have lower rates of giving. You hear that? The countries with higher taxes and bigger social safety nets produce cheaper people, produce less generous human beings. I'll explain why in a moment. In charitable giving as a percentage of GDP, nations with cradle-to-grave welfare systems rank far down the Johns Hopkins list. Sweden, 18th, France, 21st, Germany, 32nd. Why? Here's the answer. In American history, before socialism caught on, in American history, this was the belief. I have to first take care of me, then I have to take care of my family, then I have to take care of my community, and then I have to take care of my whole society. That was the belief. Socialism kills all four. The state will take care of me, the state will take care of my family, the state will take care of my community, the state will take care of my society, which produces finer people. It's so obvious that it is indeed a rhetorical question. If you think that you are morally obligated to take care of people, you're a better person than the person who thinks the state will take care of my mom. Why do I have to? And that's the way they think in much of Europe and in all of these other cradle-to-grave welfare places. Indeed, I don't have to take care of me. Today, a lot of your generation, indeed, I shouldn't say your generation, 10 years older than you, still live with their parents, playing video games in the basement. Mom and Dad will take care of me, and if they don't, the government will. The rich will take care of me. And this is considered a moral idea. Well, it obviously isn't. There is nothing more beautiful than taking care of yourself and taking care of your family and community. That's the way it worked. When I moved to California in 1976, I joined the Rotary Club. It was then all men. Men got together every week, and all they did was talk about all the good they could do for kids who had mental illness, kids who had physical deformities or whatever it might be. That's all they did at the meetings. Gee, what project will we engage in now to raise funds for people who need our help? That's what the Rotary Club and the Lions Club and all these other service clubs did. That's what Americans did. Read de Tocqueville on how Americans would form associations, non-governmental associations, to help each other. But as government gets bigger, this is my phrase, it's on a bumper sticker, you could get it from PragerU. The bigger the government, the smaller the citizen. That's what happens. As government gets bigger, we get smaller in every possible way. The state will take care of me. That's the biggest and most obvious reason socialism produces more selfish people. But I want to give you a few other insights into what the left-wing mentality does to make people worse. Number one was the state will take care of all of these people, right? That was number one. Next, I have a theory in my book on happiness. The greatest trait is gratitude. Gratitude is the mother of goodness and happiness. You can't be a happy person if you're not grateful, and you cannot be a good person if you're not grateful. All ingrates are mean. All ingrates are unhappy. All It's one of the rare absolutes that you can argue for the human race. Okay, so what produces ingratitude? Answer, the left. Who are the least grateful people to be living in the United States of America? People who think that America is sexist, intolerant, xenophobic, homophobic, Islamophobic, racist, and bigoted. They're clearly not grateful for living in the United States. They think they live in a cesspool. People living in a cesspool are not grateful. President Obama, 5 days before he was elected president in 2008, said, "We are 5 days away from fundamentally transforming the United States of America." This is one of the great differences between liberals and conservatives on the one hand and leftists on the other. Liberals never wanted to fundamentally transform America. Like conservatives, they want to improve the United States of America. You can't love or be grateful toward that which you wish to fundamentally transform. Ask, if you met a man who said, "I really love my wife, but I would like to fundamentally transform her." Okay, so that answers my question. You would find it a bit dubious, and you'd be a little skeptical as to how much he really loved her. If you loved her, you wouldn't want to fundamentally transform her. Or if you loved him, you wouldn't want to fundamentally transform him. That's the way it works. You don't love what you wish to fundamentally transform. You're not grateful to be in a place worthy of fundamental transformation. That's how much contempt the left has for the greatest country in human history. That is how much contempt, that they wish to fundamentally transform it. These people are ingrates. They are not grateful to be living in a place that has done so much for them. That is what is so amazing. And ingrates are unhappy, and all ingrates are mean. You can't, there is no kind ingrate on earth. It doesn't exist because you feel that way. So they are ungrateful for being in America, and ingratitude produces worse people. It also produces something else, which is morally problematic. Angry people. You may have met a few of them on your way in. Angry people are also not kind people. Oh, I have a friend, he's always angry, but he's such a sweet guy. He's a joy to be around. Yeah, he's angry at everybody, and he's angry all the time, but he radiates goodness. It doesn't work. The angry and the ungrateful are not nice. They're not kind. They're not good. They're so angry, they're mean. And that, so let me read to you from the New York Times 2 days ago, one of its columnists, a feminist. Are you ready? This is one of the great lines, and you know why I love this line? Because I agree with her. "Feminism is the collective manifestation of female anger." I love when I agree with people I don't agree with. That's exactly right. That's what it has become. So, by the way, her whole column is how it takes bravery to be angry, which is so bizarre that I can't begin to tell you how foolish that notion is. It takes bravery not to be angry in life. It is unbelievably easy to be angry. Every one of you has reason to be angry. There isn't a human in history of the world who didn't have a reason to be angry. That is the human condition. It takes bravery and it takes moral courage to conquer your anger and to become grateful. That's what religion does, and that is why Marx hated religion. It was the opiate of the masses. It taught the poor how to live in poverty without being angry. He hated religion because then they won't make revolutions. That's the source. That was my field, Marxism. I was at the Russian Institute at Columbia. I read this stuff. That is what he believed, and that is what the left believes to this day. A black who does not believe America is racist, a Hispanic that does not believe America is xenophobic, a woman who does not believe America is misogynist, is a defector to the cause. There is something wrong with them. They must be shut down. They're defectors. That's the way they're viewed. A happy, grateful black, happy, grateful Hispanic, happy, grateful woman. They are the enemy of the left. They are the living refutation. This is why the left produces worse people. It just does. Do they mean to? I don't care. No, I really don't care. The older you get, the more you realize in life intentions don't matter. They judge capitalism by its intentions and socialism by its intentions, and that's why they prefer socialism. Socialism doesn't work. Capitalism raised people out of poverty. Capitalism makes people care for other people. But they prefer it because capitalism is rooted in greed. Because we all know that greed is abolished as soon as you have socialism. People who are in power in socialist regimes are no longer greedy. See, look at the leaders of Venezuela. No greed. Stalin was not greedy at all. It's mind-boggling. It's just mind-boggling. It is an upside-down world in which we're living. And no place more than most universities. And by the way, speaking about universities, may I as well add my words of admiration and thanks to the president of your university. Let me end by giving you one very important moral thought, because all of my thinking in life, all of it is morally based. What advances good and what defeats evil? I am a religious Jew. I am writing a 500,000-word commentary on the Bible. Volume 1 is coming out in April on the book of Exodus. And it's called the Rational Bible because I believe reason alone can bring us to God. And I want to make a good case for the Bible for people of every background. And you know what my favorite line from the Bible is? Those of you who love God must hate evil. It's not a well-known verse. It's in the Psalms. You can't love God if you don't hate evil. That's very important. By the way, that was what alienated me from the left from my earliest days. They didn't hate communism. If you didn't hate communism, there was something morally wrong with you. 100 million people were killed by communism in the 20th century. You were supposed to hate communism and Nazism. If you only hated one, then you didn't hate evil. This is not known. The number of deaths due to communism is not known. You should all read the Black Book of Communism. It's published by Harvard, not known as a conservative entity. French scholars wrote the book on what communists, how many they killed and tortured and enslaved in every society. So what, therefore, is the most important question every society needs to answer? Here it is. How do you make people good? One of the biggest differences between conservatives, and here I even think liberals, but certainly leftists, is we believe that people are not basically good. Not evil, not necessarily believe people are basically evil, but human nature is not basically good. As I always have said, and when I've spoken about this, babies are not born good. Babies are born innocent, true, but not good. I want mommy, I want nipple, I want to be fed, I want to be comforted. And if you do not do all of these things immediately, I will ruin you. Okay? Now, I'm not blaming babies for being self-centered, but you have to grow out of self-centeredness at some point in life, or you're not good. A baby has to be self-centered or it doesn't survive. People who believe that human nature is basically good are not the heirs of the American Revolution. They are the heirs of the French Revolution. The founding fathers, the geniuses who founded our country, knew people aren't basically good. That is why God and religion are so important to every single founder. Not every founder believed in the Christian Trinity. Every founder believed in the importance of the Bible and the God of the Bible, including Franklin. Every single one. Washington said in his farewell address, I am paraphrasing, we would be fools to think we could survive without God and religion. Morality would crumble. A lot of conservatives don't know this, by the way. A lot of conservatives think that secularism is okay for America. It's okay for the government, but it's not okay for the society. The belief in the founding of this country was, if people are not going to be accountable to God, then we'll have a government to which they will feel accountable. But we don't want people accountable to the government. We want a small government. This is the only country in the history of the world founded on small government. But it won't survive if people don't have a big God to be accountable to. That's huge. The most important question, therefore, is how do you make good people? And that is why I worry. I am worried about our society. The way in which Americans made good people was through character education using the Bible. That was the way Americans made good people. They sat around at evening and they read the Bible. And they got wisdom from it. I'll end with the great epiphany of my life. It was when I was at Columbia in graduate school. And I must tell you, I was in the 70s and there was all the riots taking place. And I got to tell you, I felt like I didn't belong. I felt very out of it. And so I kept asking myself, why are so many brilliant professors teaching me nonsense? They were teaching me that men and women were basically the same, that if you gave a girl trucks, she wanted trucks, and if you gave a boy dolls, he wanted dolls. By the way, it's not true. The president of Harvard gave his daughters trucks, and they ended up with a daddy truck and a mommy truck. He tells the story. And another person who gave his daughters trucks, they ended up, the big truck had little trucks inside because the big truck was pregnant. Okay, all right, just so much. So I was taught that America and the Soviet Union were equally responsible for the Cold War. I was taught nonsense by brilliant people, and I didn't understand why. One day, walking around Columbia, so help me God, this is what happened. I wrote it, you could see it, how I found God at Columbia, it's on the internet. All of a sudden, a phrase from Hebrew came to my mind that I had said every day in the morning prayers in my yeshiva. Reshit chokhma yirat Adonai, wisdom begins with fear of God. And that answered the biggest puzzle of my life. Why was I getting no wisdom at Columbia? Because there was no God at Columbia. No God, no wisdom. There are many kind people who are atheists. There are many jackasses who are religious. I fully acknowledge that. Okay? Truth is truth. Truth is always number one. But there's no wisdom in the secular world. There's brilliance. There's knowledge. But not wisdom. That is the reason. That is the reason for the lack of wisdom conveyed in so many of our universities today. So, this is a longer talk than you may have been prepared for. These are the big themes of life today. They, meaning the left, not liberals, the left wants to undo the American Revolution. The American Revolution is founded on the American Trinity. The American Trinity is found on every coin. Liberty and God we trust, e pluribus unum. The left wants equality over liberty. It wants a godless or secular society over a God we trust society, and it wants multiculturalism rather than from many one, which is what E Pluribus Unum means. That is the battle in a nutshell. I hope you'll decide to fight it with good humor, but with great courage. Thanks for having me. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you again. Thank you. All right. Thanks so much. Always a little embarrassed. I still have to handle that better.
What's on?
All right. Oh, hey. So now, folks, by the way, I'm just don't raise your hand to make me feel good. I want to have a sense. How many of you have seen a Prager University video? Oh, wow. I'd like to see the others afterwards, if that's okay with you. That's great. That really that makes me feel good. We have over 500 million views this year. And the single largest number of viewers are under 35 years of age. So it's making a difference, and there's a lot of wisdom that can be taught in 5 minutes. And you will see all these attacks on us. By the way, you know, YouTube has restricted 30 of our videos on the grounds that they are inappropriate for young people. Do you know what one of them that they put on the inappropriate for young people is? It is one that I happen to give. I only give about 15% of the videos. And it's one that I give. I give 11 on the Ten Commandments, on each of the commandments, and then one, an introduction. They have put on the restricted list, though I just learned today it was removed from the restricted list. Is that right? Maybe. Okay. But it's been on. Thou shalt not kill. And I'm thinking, why is that inappropriate for kids? Isn't that something we would want to teach kids? It's so bizarre what they have done. Anything that defends America is immediately put on the restricted list. It's clearly not appropriate for a young person. So there are fights to be fought. Okay, so line up. Is that right? A line up? How is it working?
So we're going to be asking people to just raise their hand in the audience, and then we have a microphone over there, and then I have a microphone. And we're just going to be switching off, getting people to ask questions to Dennis. So raise your hand if you have a question. Great. So start over here. Yes. So we don't really want to hand the mics off. So
well, you might have to. I don't know what else you can do. Yeah. Because otherwise, right. I won't hear them, and most people
all
won't.
In the
just return the mic. That's all. You know. Because I have a video on do not steal as well.
Okay, so recently I've been told that as a white male that I can't have an opinion about certain topics like, you know, poverty with blacks. I can't empathize with them because I'm not black, or because I don't have a uterus. I know nothing about abortion. I know nothing about, you know, blah, 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 blah. So basically I just wanted to get your opinion on that. And what would you say to somebody that says that to you?
Well, this is very new. The notion that there is no such thing as logic or morality. This is the ultimate reductionism of moral thought into race and gender. So if you have a uterus, you can opine about abortion, but what if you have the wrong opinion? What if you think most abortions are not moral? Did you lose your uterus? What happened there? They don't believe what they're saying, because the uterus owner, and by the way, what would they do with the non-uterus owner who identifies as a woman? They are truly transphobic. Since when do you need a uterus to be a woman? That's the first reaction that I would have for that individual. They're clearly transphobic. But no, I am making fun of it because it deserves to be made fun of. I'm not making fun of transphobes. I am not making fun of those who are transgendered. A person who was not at peace with the sex into which they were born is a massive tragedy. It is a sadness that I can't even begin to imagine. So I that's all I have is sympathy. But I'm not going to change the definition of men and women because a tiny handful of people are in pain. We need to address their pain. We don't have to state that there's no definition to male and female. And by the way, if you undergo all the changes, then I honor your change. It's not. This is common sense. It's fine with me. But this notion that you can't opine on what is good for others because of your race. Well, what if you are half black and half white? Can you half opinionate? Do you have half an opinion? It is pure absurdity. I really worry about the West, because this is not just in the United States. This is true in all the Anglo-Saxon countries. Australia is as bad, Canada's as bad, and so is the UK. New Zealand has already left planet Earth, so there. That's a separate issue. But it's actually very worrisome. You can't have a moral opinion unless it affects you. But aren't girls being aborted? Anyway, the notion that the mind and morality are gender-based or race-based is, again, moving us into Nazi territory. It's very sad if people have bought this stuff. But if enough teachers tell young people these things and they don't get to see alternate opinions like tonight, or which is what they want to close down, they are afraid of people like me. And they're right to be. They really are. There is no reason or morality on their side. And so they must have a closed world that does not allow videos or speakers who have alternate opinions. That's a very, very troubling thought. You can't have an opinion if one thinks, for example, if one says, as my dear black friend Larry Elder, whom I brought to radio and is one of the most popular talk show hosts in the country, you should all tune him in. Larry Elder is one of the major intellects of our time. He's also black. He believes very simply, if you work hard, if you get married before you have children, graduate high school, get a job, you'll be fine. That's it. It doesn't matter what color you are, what race, what ethnicity, what anything. And that's the truth. Or as I would like to have a billboard. I'm thinking of this actually, because I'm thinking of having PragerU put up billboards. And it's only a matter of money. And I would like to put up a billboard that said something like this, which would reduce gun deaths more fathers or fewer guns? Okay. All right. Next, please.
All right. First of all, thank you, sir, for coming. We all appreciate you.
Thank you. Appreciate you.
So in today's society, there's this culture of being offended and being a victim, and we give virtue to that. And with identity politics, they get into office based on that. We'll help you out. And in that sense, I feel that conservatives, both in the public sphere and in politics, they failed us.
So they failed what? I'm sorry.
Conservatives have failed us as conservative citizens. I personally don't feel
right there, and they have failed us by not doing what, or by doing what?
By not doing anything to let this identity politics scene take over.
Oh, in other words, by not fighting identity
Correct.
Politics. Go on.
So I was wondering, can you speak to that? And in
yeah.
a room full of probably a bunch of young people that are going to be up and coming in politics.
Good.
Where's their voice?
I just had the honor of being invited to speak to a dozen Republican congressmen in Washington. We had about 3 hours at dinner. It was just myself and the congressman and my wife. And I told them what I tell every Republican in politics. You must understand the threat that the left is to the American project. If you don't, you're taking up space. You are not running against Joe Blow or Henrietta Blow. You are running against a person on the left. You must make clear the dangers of the left to the country, not of liberalism, but of the left. If you don't, we will lose. Identity politics is as un-American as you can get. The idea that, listen, my whole, the American Trinity, if they would just preach that, liberty in God we trust and e pluribus unum. E pluribus unum means from many one. It's the opposite of identity politics. We are all American. If you want to have your own culture, you want to honor your Italian origins, who was against that? Nobody had a problem with that. I went to a Hebrew-speaking school, but I am an American. I love America. I was taught in my yeshiva by East European Jews who survived the Holocaust that this is a melting pot. Guys with yarmulkes were telling me this is a melting pot. They didn't believe in identity politics, and they certainly had a Jewish religious identity. So this is not an issue of having an identity. A racial identity is a problematic issue. That is a problematic issue. What does the biracial person have? A biracial identity? What does the triracial person have? What if you have ancestors from four different ethnic groups? What are you then? How about American? What's wrong with that? Anyway, I obviously agree with you. Next, please. Is there only one mic to be given around? God, you are a popular man, Will. Yes, sir.
Hey, Dennis, huge fan.
Thank you.
So, like you, I think that it's crazy how socialism and those ideas have infiltrated the youth of America. And my question is, what do you think, like, the root cause or some of the root causes is of this newfound idealism?
You mean the newfound idealism of the left, you mean? Yeah, well, okay, why are they believing in things that are so irrational on the one hand and un-American on the other? I spent a lot of time trying to figure the answer to that out. Where did these things come from? And the answer is, I have a theory, I hate to say this, because I'm very, very close to a number of individual Germans. So this obviously is not applicable to all Germans, but Germany has been a big problem for the last 150 years. I don't think that's a controversial statement to make among people who know the last 150 years. But it starts before World War I. Do you know where Americans went in the late 1800s for PhDs? Because American universities very rarely awarded PhDs. They went to Germany. And the Germans had already been flirting with socialism. And that's where a lot of these ideas were nurtured. It takes a long time to undo the soil at Harvard until 1800 if you didn't know Hebrew. That is how much you had to study the Bible. Did you know that the insignia, look it up when you get home, it's fun. The insignia of Yale University is in Hebrew. It's from the high priest of the Bible. It says Urim V'Tumim. Most people who know Hebrew don't even know what it's about. Is the high priest wore this breastplate, and on it said Urim V'Tumim. That is how immersed they were. The Liberty Bell, is taken from the Hebrew Bible, from the Torah. The only verse on the Liberty Bell. These were Bible-based universities, founded by Bible-based people who believe you had to study God and the Bible. Theology is the study of God. But with the PhDs from Germany coming back, it started to stop, and that is where a lot of the origins, and finally coming to fruition, with what you see today. How many of you have heard the phrase the greatest generation as applied to the World War II generation? About half of you. Okay, my father fought in World War II. They were a great generation. I don't know if they were the greatest. There were a lot of great American generations. But in any event, they were a great generation. But they made one huge mistake. They didn't teach their children, that's my generation, the baby boomers, what America was about. They took it for granted. They didn't think they had to teach their kids what it was about. And as Franklin put it to a woman who said, how long will we have our country? He answered, as long as you can keep it. If you don't teach good values for one generation, it's all lost. It's unbelievably easy to destroy. It's unbelievably hard to build. I always say to the left, because they're very angry at the Boy Scouts, they say the Boy Scouts are homophobic and all sorts of things. And I've always said, so why doesn't the left create a Boy Scouts? Right? If you don't like the way the Boy Scouts are run, why don't you make an organization that shapes boys into men? The single most important project in any society is shaping boys into men. But they don't. They only know how to destroy. There's no left-wing Boy Scouts. It doesn't exist. It will never exist. So that generation, my parents' generation, not in my own parents' case, but in many parents' cases, didn't teach what we stand for. We have to redo the American Revolution. That's your job. It's my job too. But that's our job, or we'll lose it. Next, please.
Thank you for coming.
Yep. Right.
With the left so entrenched in many academic institutions, how do you take that control back or battle that?
Well, I have some very troubling answers. In many cases, it's a very big mistake to give money to universities. Private individuals, they're still in love with their alma mater, even though their alma mater, people will give, let's say, to Yale. Yale now, you can get a BA in English and not read one Shakespeare play. University of Pennsylvania took down the mural of Shakespeare in the English department because he's a white European male. I thought he wrote the best plays in human history. I didn't think he was up there because he was white or male. I thought he was up there because he wrote the best plays. The President of the United States, Donald Trump, said in Poland a few months ago that we have to protect Western civilization. From the New York to the LA Times, the entire left-wing media, which is redundant, said this was a whistle call to white supremacists. So they equate preserving Western civilization with white supremacy. In other words, there's nothing intrinsic in Western civilization to protect. The New York Times classical music reviewer chided the president for saying that we have to, after all, protect the symphony. Who else wrote the symphony? It came from the West. Now, I know a lot about classical music. I conduct symphony orchestras as an avocation. And so I know the symphony or the concerto or the piano sonata or the violin sonata or the trio. I mean, Western music is the greatest music ever written. That's not because I'm Western. Japanese believe that. The Japanese are producing the best Bach recordings in the world today. Not because he's European, but because Bach wrote the greatest cantatas ever written in history, period. They are crazy about Beethoven. They are crazy about Bach because it's the greatest music. Hey, I love Jewish music, but I don't compare what I sing in synagogue to Beethoven. It's like it's another world. Hello, I know that. I know that. It's lovely, but that's all it is. But the guy at the New York Times wrote, obviously the president has never listened to Indonesian gamelan music. So I decided to listen to Indonesian gamelan music because he said that is comparable to Beethoven's Third Symphony. So I played Indonesian gamelan music on the radio for my listeners. I am not knocking Indonesian gamelan music. There's no doubt it has depth and emotional power to Indonesians that I don't relate to, just as my synagogue service has songs that you wouldn't relate to, like gefilte fish. None of you would relate to gefilte fish. You never even heard of it, which is your lucky day. It is a Jewish food that is really made for cats, but humans eat it. In any event, the notion that this guy is serious, Indonesian gamelan music is on the same plane as Beethoven's Third, it's an insult to Indonesians. They don't believe it. There's a Jakarta Symphony Orchestra, but there's no New York Gamelan Orchestra. That's the problem. But we can't say these things. So it's a big battle. We take a couple of more. Who's got a mic? Because I can't call on you. It's really up to Will. And by the way, if you slip him a dollar, he may, just a thought. Go ahead. Yes.
Hi. I have been personally affected by socialism because I grew up in Venezuela. And so you mentioned Venezuela, and I'm just curious what you think the solution is for Venezuela.
It's the same solution as in Cuba, because it's really becoming a Castroite suburb. It's particularly dramatic because Venezuela was one of the richest countries in South America until Chavez took over. Do you know what is interesting among the many terribly interesting things, both terrible and interesting? All of the Hollywood leftists and all of the politicians on the left who went to celebrate Chavez's victories. Why? Because he used the word equality. Remember, the left doesn't care about whether people are poor. It cares whether there are people who are rich and people are poor. So they have succeeded in getting rid of the rich in Venezuela to a large extent. They're either poor or they've left to America. And now the left is undoubtedly pleased with, they won't admit it, because even they acknowledge it's not a pretty sight when you have to line up for toilet paper and you're a doctor. We have a video on Venezuela given by, have you seen it? Given by Dinesh D'Souza's wife, who is Venezuelan. By the way, that's all of South America in a nutshell. We have a great video given by a Guatemalan. And the theme is, why do you want to make in America what you fled from in Latin America? The Pope is a leftist. And if you think I'm picking on Catholics, let me tell you, most Jews are leftists too. The leftism is the most dynamic religion of the last 100 years, much more dynamic than Judaism, Christianity, or even Islam. But Latin America bought into leftism. We have a lot of Latin American young people who watch our videos. One of them called my show a Venezuelan. And he told me, I felt silly not knowing this, the opposition to Maduro is also a socialist. So what is that guy's argument? Not that socialism is bad, but Maduro is bad, just like Republicans. That Democrat's bad, not the left. My opponent is bad. Your opponent is interchangeable. If every Democrat in Congress were absconded by extraterrestrials, it wouldn't matter. 535 new extraterrestrials would show up. It doesn't matter. So that's it's pitiful. It's just pitiful what's happening there. All right, two more. I always believe the audience should leave before the speaker does. It's an old tradition of mine. But yes.
Hi, Dennis. My question is that the way life works as a student is sometimes you're expected to give certain answers or write certain papers or write the things that people want to hear. And that's not exactly my question, but what I was wondering is how do you get up every day and create like the good and the value and the things you want to bring to the world in this world we're in.
Well, if I hear you right, I will, let me rephrase it in the words of a mother who called my show. She said to me, tell me if this is what you're asking. She said, what do I tell my daughter at college? If my daughter writes what she believes, she will get a worse grade than if she writes leftist pablum that the teacher wants and get an A for. Is that what you're basically asking? Okay. Well, you may not like my answer, but I will tell you what I said to her. This is what I said. If your daughter compromises on her values for a grade in college, when will she stop compromising on her values later in life? If you're college age, I'm three times older than you. I don't normally pull rank like that, but the reason I'm mentioning it is, if you didn't learn more in your 60s than in your 20s, you are really a dummy. So I will tell you something that you need to hear. Over the long run, number one, life is a marathon, not a sprint. It's very important for you to remember. You don't have to win now. You have to be able to look back at a life well lived much later on. It's very, very important. Number two, integrity over the long run does win. That's what you need to know. You may not get the best grades, so you may not therefore get into the most prestigious graduate school or the most prestigious law firm. So what? Over the long term, integrity wins. I'm not speaking from a moral standpoint, from a selfish standpoint. If you are true to your highest values now and always, you will prevail over time. You will lose at times, but you will keep yourself. And it works. Over time, it does work. So just know that. Let me tell you this thing about college, okay? Because this drives me crazy. And I have two boys. I raised them, I don't give a damn what college you go to. It's very atypical for Jewish parents who, when you say to a Jew, how are you, they tell you what college their daughter goes to. How are you? Oh, my daughter's at Yale. Oh, great. But how are you? My daughter's at Yale. I told you how I am. So this is really unhealthy. It's a very unhealthy thing. But I don't have that at all. I didn't give a damn where my kids went to college. And I wasn't even that emphatic that they go to college. I want them to be good people, productive human beings, good Americans, hopefully religious people too, and that's what I want from them. And I always tell the story on my radio show when people think how important it is to get into the best college. So here's an interesting little anecdote for you. I have been broadcasting 33 or 34 years. I have been asked everything because I answer everything. I'm very open. People ask me about my own life, about my family, about my divorce, my religion. Everything. You can ask anything you want. And I answer. And it has been very effective. Even though it's difficult, it's been very effective. The first thing people say to me in the street or at an airport is, hi, I feel like I know you. And I always answer, you do. And that's fine. So here is a very interesting little anecdote. I have been asked everything. I have never once, ever been asked what college did I go to. I give people my opinions on life, on politics, on men and women, on happiness, on good and evil, on God, every day, 3 hours a day, and no one has ever asked what college did you go to. Why is that? Because they don't give a damn. That's why. You know who gives a damn what college you go to? In high school, the teachers do, many parents do, but in life, no one will. It won't matter. And I am a living example of it. So just know that. Your character is numero uno. By the way, I got to tell you something. It says a lot for you that you applauded that line. It does. I'm not kidding. Maybe I'll move to Wyoming. Yeah. You're up for it. Yeah. I love it here. I do. I love it here. It's very special. My favorite line with one of your fellow students who was a protester on my radio show. He said, I have to admit, I love my line. If you can love your own lines, I love my own line. Because it was true, not because it was witty. It was witty, but it was true. That was what mattered. So he said something to the effect, people in Wyoming are really wonderful people. And I said, I know that. And then I said, and conservative. And he said, that's right. And I said, that's why. That's right. So listen, you've been great. I've had a ball. It worked out beautifully, and I'm just thrilled about that. So just fight the good fight with good cheer, with good character, and I'd love to come back. So thank you for having me. God bless
thank
you.
You.
Thank you. Thank you again. It's been wonderful. It's been wonderful. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Thank you.